I think an absence of something is what drew me back. I don't know. A lot of people will say like the absence of the gift of the Holy Ghost. I don't know that it was entirely that, but it definitely felt like, you know, before I was in a situation and I felt a little bit more whole, and then I didn't, and I guess I felt that the church in some way, being a member, an active, a baptized member of the church, would sort of fill that gap back up, and it did. So I think that's probably, there were the three or four main reasons that brought me back.
You're listening to The Busy Latter-day Saint, where righteous desires and living life come together. I'm your host, Richard Bernard. Because this podcast ends on a spiritual high, I do not add any comments at the end, so I add them here. You can help support this podcast by sharing it with friends and family, clicking the follow button and giving it a star rating. I'm also the host of the Everyday Saint podcast, aired by Cedar Fort Publishing and Media. There I have the wonderful opportunity to interview authors published by Cedar Fort and learn about their new books. I encourage you to check it out. There's a link in the show notes. Lastly, I want to thank two talented musicians for their intro and outro music, Angie Gillian and Marvin Goldstein. Both of them have been guests on this podcast. See the show notes for more information on their music. Richard Stedman, host of the popular podcast The Cultural Hall, better known as Richie, by the way, joins us today. He shares his love of the church, his faith, and his love of church history. By the way, did you know the church had a church bar? Well, there's this and much more. And now, here's Richard. Richard, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing this morning?
I am fantastic. Thank you for asking.
Did you shovel your snow yet?
I don't. I have made a 2024 resolution wherein I am not going to shovel snow this year.
Oh, okay. So when it gets to be 6 feet, what do?
I drive over it, and I actually have the previous owners of my home left me. The only thing that they left me was several bags of ice melt. And so it is my intention to, I don't want to, you know, they say waste not, want not. I'm not going to waste that stuff. So instead of shoveling, I am egregiously spreading ice melt in the hopes that I'll use it all this year, and then maybe I'll return to shoveling in 2025.
Do you have a four-wheel drive?
I have an all-wheel drive, lest anyone be concerned that I'm putting like neighbors at risk with sidewalk or anything like that, my particular street does not have a sidewalk. So if someone slips and falls where I haven't shoveled, it's their fault for coming onto my property.
Oh, I don't know if that holds up in court, but anyway.
Well, I mean, I don't have, as far as I can tell, by city statute, I do not have a responsibility to have to clear the snow from my cemented property where I have cement. So
okay,
I'm going to try it. It's my New Year's resolution.
Okay.
We can always change them or stop them.
Well, we will see. Maybe your wife has a different opinion.
Well, my wife always has a different opinion, but about this, nah, she's fine. Because the conversation has come about, well, do you think that we should shovel it? And then I look to her and I said, would you like to shovel it? And she says, I love this resolution. And then we go back to what we were doing otherwise.
I see. Okay.
It's good exercise. I still, in Utah last year was so much snow that I feel like that did me for a couple of years. If I don't have to shovel snow for a little bit, I'm fine. I'm okay about it.
Yes, last year was quite an adventure as far as snow. I love the snow, and I love wintertime. It's my favorite time, and I don't mind shoveling. It's good exercise, and I'm retired, so I can go out when I want to do it. And in fact, when we get done here, I'll go out and grab the shovel and clear things up.
Well, I'll send you my address. I can tell that you are very concerned about the snow at my house. I'll just message you my address, and then we'll see if the words match the deeds.
Well, it all depends how many acres you have.
almost one, but it's just a very small swath of cement that you would need to clear.
All right. Well, now, you're an experienced podcaster. How long have you been doing it?
Well, so podcasting, we recorded our first episode in First episode of the Cultural Hall back in, I want to say that we recorded it in like January of 2011, but we didn't technically publish it until April 6th of 2011.
Okay. Now, you were doing it before people knew what a podcast was.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, now with, 4 or 5 million plus, I think when I first got in, there was maybe 100,000 podcasts. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely the technology was new. The, like, telling people what a podcast was always my favorite. They're like, yeah, but what station is it on? And it's like, no, that's not what this is. But what time do I listen to it? Whenever you'd like. How can I listen to it whenever I'd like? Never mind. Forget it. You'll figure it out sometime. That's what a podcast
is. Well, now, I'm curious, back then, how did you get the word out that you had a podcast?
Well, so social media was still around quite a bit. And so what we would do, and this was back when social media would not only allow you to share links to, you know, your particular show or whatever, but they would keep those links and people would be able to see them. Nowadays, you post something on social media and it's, you know, you feel like nobody sees it, and it's because no one does really see it. But back then it was all about organic. And so you could post something like, I did an interview with Richard Bernard, and people would be like, Richard Bernard. And anyone who I was connected to would likely see that. Nowadays, you know, your wife might see it and my wife might see it. And that would be where that would go to die if I post that on social media. So mainly social media. And then I think that there was a lot of, and you don't see this anymore as well, like if I interviewed you, you would be really excited because you'd be like, oh my gosh, I was on this thing called a podcast and you have to check it out. Whereas I feel like most people now in 2024, as we record this, have either, you know, done a podcast, been a co-host on a podcast, have been interviewed for some sort of podcast, or, you know, it's not as exciting to them. So they wouldn't rush to their social media to say, check this out, listen to this, I was on this thing. It's just not the same.
Well, now, just from a technical standpoint, what equipment did you have back then?
You know, quite honestly, the same equipment that I have now for the most part. The mic that I'm using today is a little bit nicer than the mic I had back then. The board that I'm using now is a little bit nicer than the board that I had back then. But I had the luxury, so I come up through broadcasting. So I was aware of a lot of the things and just sort of transferred from what would have been, you know, over the radio waves broadcasting equipment into podcasting equipment, and then had the same editing software, but obviously a newer version now. Had the same sort of board, but obviously a newer version now, and was just able to go about it that way.
Well, now, your life in particular, have you always been a member of the church?
Well, that's an interesting question that you ask me. No, and also yes. I was born in the church, and then at the age of 8 was baptized. Funny story about being baptized. My dad held me down so long that the bishop, when I came up, said, Kerry, that's my dad's name, he said, Kerry, if you'd held him under 1 second longer, I was about to jump in and save him. And my dad, without any sort of hesitation, said, well, he's extra dirty. I wanted to make sure he got good and clean. And that was the exchange after I got baptized. When I was about almost 22, February of the year that I turned 22, I am birthday in June, so essentially 22, I was excommunicated from the church, and then remained excommunicated for nearly a decade, and then was rebaptized, then readmitted, and, you know, blessings restored and all that. And so since that time have been a member of the church. So technically, no, have not been a member of the church all my life, but, you know, still went to church even as an excommunicated member, etc. Stayed close to the gospel, watching general conference, all of those things. But if we're going to get downright technical to it, I know I was not.
Mm. Now, you said at age 22, I see some from notes here, you served a mission in Cleveland, Ohio.
I did, in fact. The best mission in the world.
Okay, so you came off your mission and then was excommunicated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not right off the plane. had to have some time, but be pretty close. Yeah. Okay. Less than a year being home from my mission.
Okay. Well, I'm curious, what brought you back?
Lots of things, I think. A desire. I knew where I wanted to be. I knew, I knew what was true. I knew what I had taught people and believed that. I think that that was probably the largest part of it, but not the entire part of it. I think that a large amount of my identity, both as an individual and as a member of like my family, sort of resides in my faith, being a Mormon person, culturally Mormon or a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So I think that that was a part of it. I think an absence of something is what drew me back. I don't know. A lot of people say like the absence of the gift of the Holy Ghost. I don't know that it, it was entirely that, but it, it definitely felt like, you know, before I was in a situation and I felt a little bit more whole and then I didn't. And I guess I felt that the church in some way, being a member, an active, a baptized member of the church would sort of fill that gap back up, and it did. So I think that, that that's probably, there were the three or four main reasons that brought me back, would be those.
Well, now, what concerns did you have about the church?
Well, I mean, that is an interesting question. So are you asking, so the reason why I was excommunicated was nothing to do with concerns that I had with the church.
Oh, okay.
If that if that's the question that you are asking.
Yes.
But yes, do I have concerns about the church? Of course. I think that anyone who loves the church and wants to see it succeed has things that they go, guys, is this the best way forward? I hope so, because I don't know that I would pick it this way. So, I mean, yeah, that, that would be that.
All right. Well, let's get further in your life. It says here you love the theater and fine arts.
I do. As a matter of fact, in a play right now, not right this second, obviously, we're doing this interview, but... we open a show tonight at a theater in Utah called the Desert Star Theater, where they do spoofs and parodies. And tonight we open up a show called Pirates of the Caribbean, which, as you could probably guess, it's a spoof of the Disney movie and ride Pirates of the Caribbean.
Now, where is this theater located?
It's in Murray, so center of the Salt Lake Valley, like 49th South and State Street.
Okay.
It's been around for about 35, 36 years, and their bread and butter is making family theater that uses a lot of culture as its jokes and is family-friendly. So you go, you know that you're not going to have anything that you're going to have to explain to your kids on the way home and say, mm-hmm. well, I'm not telling you what that is, or we'll talk about that when you're older. There's not any of those things, but it is, it's a fun couple hours we do. About 90 minutes of a play, and then we take a break, and then we come back and do what's called an oleo, but it's essentially a musical review where we're singing popular songs to a theme. Like our oleo for this particular show is a flower power oleo, so it's all songs from the 70s and late 60s, and you know it's a lot of peace signs and love is the answer in the oleo. So we have a good time with that.
Well, now what do you enjoy about acting?
A couple things. One, I feel like it is the exercising of God-given talent, which maybe sounds pretentious, but I feel like God blessed me with the ability to be able to do that. I think that 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to say that statement, but when I recognize, you know, God made people very different, and the fact that whether it's the courage or the talent or whatever the thing is that that he has blessed me with to... be able to, you know, act it, act literally in those capacities is not something that everybody can do. And so it's a fulfillment of what I feel like God would have me do in some form or fashion. The other thing is, I really enjoy that when people come to a theatrical experience, particularly there, but anywhere, that what they're seeking is an escape from their life, right? Life at home may be hard. Maybe they're not getting along with their spouse. Maybe a medical concern has them this. A child isn't doing this thing. Whatever the thing may be, they get a respite for a couple of hours where they don't have to think about that. And to be able to be a purveyor of like a break for someone just seems seems like a really great blessing. Like, I like that perspective of what I do. And then the final thing is, and people that perform and create will know this probably more than others, but there is something to, like, we do the same script every night for the most part, right? But we also allow, you know, if something happens during the show, power goes out, we've had a fire before at the theater, different things that will happen. We don't encourage that, but certainly life happens, right? But those things will get incorporated into what we're doing. And even if there's not some, like, big thing like that, every audience is different. And so some night, one joke may hit a little bit different. And so every night it feels like I'm playing with friends to create an experience that one night is the only time that experience will happen. And sometimes it's because of casting. Sometimes it's because of the people that are in attendance. Sometimes it's because one of those things happens that will never happen again, a fire, a power outage, whatever the thing may be. But it is unique and it is creative, and you have to live in the moment of it, be aware of everything that's going on to be able to capitalize on it. And then at the end, you go, that was a great thing, and that was it. I can't do that again. Mm-hmm. And some people try and make the thing happen again, and it's not ever the same. Right. And so it's a perspective, the older that I've gotten, to try and look at sort of life that way, is sometimes we think it's, oh, it's got to be this and this, and if I can do this and then repeat this and all that, and I think, no, I think that there's just sort of the moments that it comes and you go, this is the moment. Man, now this moment is gone.
Do you do any improv?
Of course, life, man. But also I do improv. And there's improvisation that is allowable within the script. But I've also been a part of improv troupes, started improv troupes, okay. Things like you'd see on Whose Line Is It Anyway? Those kind of short form games are really fun to do too. That's not this, but I do love doing that.
Yeah, we have a daughter that was involved in doing improv.
And, oh, very cool. Yeah. With a troupe or professionally or?
Well, it was with her friends. She did it during high school. Got involved with it in high school, and then once she moved up here to Utah. Some of her friends went, actually, there's a little theater there in Provo. Can't remember the name of it. But
there's Comedy Sports is a place, or Improv, yeah. Broadway are two that are in.
Yeah,
Provo.
I think it was Comedy Improv. Sports, yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, she had time with that. It's fun. It's fun, yeah. To see people to just start working off the top of their head and go crazy. It's really wonderful. Now, I see here... Again, I'm looking at your notes from your website for your podcast. It says you were voted Mr. SUU. Now, how do you get voted to be that? And do you have a plaque or a trophy or what? What goes with this?
A clock, actually. I've got a clock that says Mr. SUU. How about that, huh? Yeah, I don't know. It's a... You know, they have they had a like a Miss Southern Utah University. That's what the SUU stands for, and that was like a qualifying thing. If they wanted to become Miss Utah, you could do that. So that was a formal pageant, and as they often do on the college level, they sort of allow these Mr. pageants that aren't serious by any means, and that's what the Mr. SUU pageant was. So we had a ridiculous question that we had to answer on stage, and you had to have a talent that you did for everyone, and then people voted, and the judges voted, and then if you were the most voted thing, you got to be Mr. SUU. I was first attendant the year before, and then I made it through to Mr. SUU.
Well, now, did you have to wear a special swimsuit?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that. For my particular talent, what I did was an interpretive dance. And so I got one of those large industrial fans up on the stage with me, just if you can imagine, like human-sized large fans. And then the leotard that I wore, technically a unitard, but had a bunch of frills and things, and so I danced in the mirror. So not a bathing suit, but... there was very little left to an audience participate an audience participant's imagination. It was, it was all out there.
Well, perhaps that's why you got chosen.
Yeah, it could be.
Well, now, what do you do for a living?
Yeah, good question. So for 20 years, I worked in the broadcast industry, and most recently, I worked for BYU Radio. About a year and a half ago, we had a meeting where they said, here's the future, and here's what your part in it is. And I said, I am done with this. And then I thought maybe I was being a little bit emotional, so I came home, talked to my wife, as one should do before they quit their job. And I said, okay, I'm going to sleep on it. And then I woke up the next morning, and I was like, nope, I'm quitting my job. And so I went in, and I texted my HR lady, who was a friend of mine, and I said, let me know when you get in. She got into her office. I said, how do I quit? And she said, you just did. And I said, perfect. And then I said, I don't have to work 2 weeks, do I? And she said, nope. And I was like, good, because I didn't want to. I'll get my things tomorrow, and I'll see you on Friday and get my things done. So now, long answer to your short question, I DJ weddings and community events and MC those things. I also edit podcasts for individuals like yourself if they don't want to take on the editing and they have the means to be able to pay me to do it. I have clients that will have me do that for them. And other companies and individuals who want to get into podcasting, but they need someone to walk alongside them in a consulting role or more of a hands-on role, I'll do that with them as well and enable other people to be podcasters. So I sort of take a little bit from column A and column B, and column C is able to pay the mortgage, which we've been pretty blessed with.
Well, yes, that's important, and be able to put shoes on the children's feet.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very important. Well, now, you, how many people are you editing podcasts for?
So actively right now, four, but we have like four additional that are, they had been going and for one reason or another decided to stop for a minute, but with the new year have intentions to come back. We also do audiobooks as well. So those will come on when people hear about us and then come and say, hey, you know what, you guys do this book and I can record in my studio. That's where I'm at right now in my house. And then be able to edit it. But we've had as many as 12 before, and they kind of come and go, as you can imagine. And as you've experienced, you may start a podcast 100 episodes ago, and you started with 10 friends, and you're the only one still going because everyone else has quit. And then some people come back and rebrand and all the things. But we usually have anywhere between like four and six clients.
Well, now, you said you also help those starting a podcast. Mm-hmm. What exactly do you do in that role?
Yeah, interesting. So different for different people. Some people will be like, we really want to do a podcast for, for example, there's a city in Utah that wants to do a podcast. And so a gentleman that works within the city government reached out and said, here's what we want to do, and we want it to not be terrible. What do you think we need to do? And so in that capacity, I did sort of two parts. One is they didn't know what equipment they needed. They could probably have researched it, but, you know, a lot of people will, rather than, you know, really take the time, they find someone who knows and they say, here are some shekels. Tell me what I need. I don't want to have to do this because I'm worried about another part of it. So they did that part of it. And then the other thing is that we really talk through how to identify who your audience is going to be and then be able to speak to that audience. A lot of times people will be like, I have a really great idea. We're going to answer questions. That's going to be our podcast. And that's a great idea. There are successful, you know, podcasts that just answer questions. But, you know, are you answering medical questions? Are you answering tax questions? You know, being able to really help people focus their idea, I think, allows people to be more successful because then they can connect to their niche quicker. It allows them to be able to feel like they are getting traction with what they're doing, especially if they have something kind of down funnel that they're, you know, the podcast is attracting people to them and then they want to sell a book or they've got a class or a mastermind or whatever the thing is. The quicker you can attach to your niche, allows people to feel like they're making their money back quicker, because it is an investment to do a podcast. So anything like that. And some people just want someone to tell them that was good, or don't say or, you know, you talked for 2 hours to a guy about nothing, or be longer. You only talked for 3 minutes. Some people just need that person to walk alongside them and go, yeah, keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now in today's market, what do you tell them about getting the word out?
Yeah, good question. Particularly about podcasts, I think there are a few things. One, still going to social media and telling people that you do it, I think is, even if it doesn't touch, you know, the thousands of people that it used to, I think that for the people that do see it, it keeps it top of mind. So-and-so has a podcast, the podcast is about that, and then you sort of create an instant connection in people's brains to go, Elder Barnard does podcast. His podcast is about this. If I ever think of something that would be to him, I'll make sure and mention that to him. So I think that that is important. I think that telling people, talking to people about it, you don't want to be the guy or girl who always is talking about your podcast. But I think being able to say if there's a particular episode that you like to people that you know would be potential listeners, I think that that's valuable. I think that the greatest evangelical tool that you can have for a podcast is the people that listen to it. If you tell them, hey, I feel like this was a great episode. If you felt like it was, is there someone that you can think of that would particularly benefit from the message that we shared today? Someone that is struggling with the thing or needs the advice that this podcast episode had, share it with them. And then lastly, I think that there's a tremendous amount of value if done correctly, that if you put yourself out there to be on other people's shows and then say, you know what, I do a thing and this is this thing and I'd love to have you be a part of this thing if that sounds attractive to you. I think that done right and done well can attract an audience. But it's also to remember that, you know, if someone is promising to make something an overnight success and thousands or tens of thousands of downloads, it probably is too good to be true.
I had never heard of you, and I never heard of your podcast until...
Well, I've never heard of you either.
And one, we evidently have mutual listeners, because someone contacted me and said, you have to be on Richard's podcast called The Cultural Hall. And you need to contact him and tell him you need to be on there. And so I think I did reach out about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and never heard back. And so then I had somebody approach me recently and said, you really need to be on Richard's podcast. And and so that's how I finally, so I started listening to your podcast, and they are great. And so
thank you.
For those that haven't heard of your podcast, what exactly is the purpose of it?
Yeah, interesting, right? People will ask me this, and I feel like, especially the podcast consultant within me, feels like I should be able to say, the Cultural Hall podcast, or show available in podcast form, is a show that talks about all things Mormon and a new age, blah, 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 right? Some sort of elevator pitch. That's what I would tell my clients to do. But for me in particular, I feel like it has become so many different things over the years that I've done it that I'm not sure I know exactly what it is. Initially created so that I could meet air quotes famous Mormon people. That's why I wanted to start it. I guess even before that, I had a couple of friends who were starting podcasts, and I was like, I want to start a podcast. So that's what kind of started it. And then I was like, I want to meet my famous Mormon people. And then as we started to get some traction, I was like, oh, you know what? There's got to be more to this than that. And we started talking about some of the harder things within the church. And then, being able to connect with people that have successes and people who have struggles. There's something... I'm not sure this is a word, ministerial to me about that. I feel ministering when I have the opportunity to do that. So it feels super fulfilling for me to do that. I think that there's an element of, like, you know, talent and ability that I feel like God has given me, that it almost feels, we don't hear this so much in LDS culture, but certainly in evangelical or others, that they're like, God called me to this. I think I feel a little bit of that, a responsibility to now talk about the hard things. I think that there are enough people that anticipate how we will talk about the harder things, that now I almost feel like that that owing it to people that have been with us for so long to say, new policy, new handbook, new whatever the thing is, you probably want to know what we think about it, and we're going to be right alongside you. And then other times I've thought, you know, it simply put, maybe it's just like it's my adventure through the church. Because we will have very, like, planned out kind of seasons or parts of seasons of episodes. And then I'll get a church history bug and I'll just chase down everything about that. Or there's a particular topic and then a lot of episodes will start to gear around that. So there isn't always the rhyme or reason. It's just sometimes a thing where I go, well, I'm really fascinated by, you know, the LDS Reformation. Let's do, you know, 10 episodes about that. And people are like, we get it. We get it. There was a Reformation. Come on, move along. And other times it's just, you know, someone will reach out and be like, hey, you should have me on. Okay, let's talk about it.
Well, now you are interested in church history.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed Susan Easton Black, which certainly is one of the experts there on church history. What is it you like about church history?
I think twofold. One, that being able to serve in Cleveland, I got to spend some time in Kirtland and Hiram. There are other places of note, but the ones that people will know there, Kirtland, Hiram. So I think that having that connection to that really close spiritual time in my life, I think that that's part of it. But, you know, since serving a mission and having the opportunity to go to other church historical sites, I think the thing that I really like about it is that it feels recent and it feels different in that I can go there. You know, I can remember distinctly a time in Hiram at the Johnson Farm. There is, or at least was when I was there last, stoop where after Joseph Smith was tarred and feathered that he stood on and preached the morning after he was tarred and feathered, that was still there.
Mm.
That actual, you know, piece of, I think it was kind of rock that had been quarried and then brought there. And I just remember thinking, yeah, no, that it wasn't a rock like this. It wasn't a rock that was made of this same stone. It wasn't, you know, something like that. It was this very thing in this very place that, to me, I just think it's significant to me to be able to kind of have not that proof necessarily, but that connection with that. And then the other thing I think that attracts me to church history is that it is both messy and weird. And I think I also like that aspect of it. I like to know the messy things. I don't ever want to be surprised about something. And then I also like to know just the weird things where people are like, no, the LDS church has never owned a bar. And it's like, well, actually, yes, they have. And we can, you know, those things that people just sort of say because they feel like they know what they say. And it's like, no. But also, the LDS church can have owned a bar and still be the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and there's not. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't have to be, I feel like, what so many people make it out to be.
Well, now, I didn't know the church owned a bar. When was that?
Yeah. So when they purchased the Newell K. Whitney store back from the owners when they were purchasing the land in Cleveland, it was a bar for a short time because they had a lease or some sort of contractual obligation with the person who had previously owned it to allow that person to continue to function within that role for a short time before that person had to vacate the Newell K. Whitney store. So it was it really that they owned a bar? No, but it is interesting. It is a weird thing. It is a thing to say. Yeah, I mean, no, we don't typically own a bar, but in this case, it can be said that the LDS Church owned a bar.
Well, that's certainly a conversation starter.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Well, let's turn to the scriptures. What part do the scriptures play in your life?
You know, varied over the years. I would say, as a missionary, I feel like it was like, man, it was an incompleteness if I didn't have that exact amount of time that we were supposed to, right? It was very diligent of like, this is the amount of time and this is what I'm going to get into it. And really absorbed myself into it. Then going into college upon returning, the way that I sort of found myself attracted to the scriptures is I wanted to study them. So I got a bunch of like the, institute manuals that are like, here's what this is. And then, you know, McConkie's this on the scriptures and the commentary on the this. And so you've got the scriptures as sort of the main fold and you're like, and what is this? And what, you know, all that. I think that it has probably more in the last, five or six years. The scriptures have been a reverent place for me. A place where when reading them or even just thinking about reading them, it feels different. It feels like a I guess sacred is the word I'm looking for. A kind of a sacred time when, even if I'm not like receiving revelation while reading the scriptures, it just feels like a time where no matter what life is going on or what needs to happen or what I should be doing, you know, those moments when I can find myself into the scriptures that I go, okay, peace. And to me, that's, you know, in a world of chaos and a life of chaos, that to me feels like, worth every bit of it. It eludes me more than it used to. I don't think that I study nearly as much, certainly as I should, but we shouldn't should ourselves. That part of it is an interesting thing to me. With the coming of the new year, I certainly, and the studying of the Book of Mormon, I've sort of reinvested myself into thinking, okay, let's do this. Let's make this a daily time when I can do it and maybe do it in a place and find a different way to study so that I get not excited like I need to be excited about the Word of God, but like, you know, have some motivation to do something new, because otherwise it's Nephi's family went into the wilderness. You know, like I sort of talk myself into this mundaneness of it, and I know once I get into it that that's not what I'll feel. But in anticipating the time to read it, I don't allow myself to see what it could be.
Yes. A vast majority of the members of the church do not study the scriptures daily.
Yeah.
They struggle with it. And I remember asking Susan Black, when she studies the Doctrine and Covenants, what does she do? I mean, she's one of the great minds concerning that. And she says, I always turn to the Lord and say, what is in this that I just don't know yet? And that's what we have to do. I read the Book of Mormon every day, and when I get to the end, I go right back to the beginning, even if the Come Follow Me is on the New Testament or the Old Testament. And sometimes you're right, especially at the beginning of the Book of Mormon, which everybody knows, according to President or Elder Bednar, everyone stops right there where it starts with Isaiah.
Yep.
And then they put it back on the shelf. And then they come back to it again. So we all know the first part. And as I'm reading that, those first few chapters with my wife each morning, it's, you know, what is there in this that I just don't see yet? And that's what we really need to do. I am curious, during the period of time you were not a member of the church, did the scriptures play any part in your life?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so I was a regular church attender in the time that I was not a member of the church. So within, you know, like religious attendance and that had the scriptures. There would be times within that window of time where I would feel particularly drawn to them, and to the point of being like, hey, so I should back up a little bit. So during the 10 years, there were a couple of times where I made the push to be rebaptized, and it didn't occur. But part of those sort of moments of intensity trying to be rebaptized, those were often accompanied by a rigorous or far more rigorous study of the scriptures.
Okay. Well, now, when you study the scriptures, what do you do?
Yeah, okay. So I'm assuming you're saying, like, so I am a paper scripture guy because the electronics for me, I am a notification away from being 2 hours of scrolling before I realize I was studying my scriptures at the start of everything. So for me, I am paper in a room that is away from other distractions and then just being able to sit down. I'll oftentimes have either a companion piece, one of those institute or some other sort of commentaries about it, or a journal or piece of paper, something that I can, you know, jot something down to go, I don't know about this. This is something that strikes me. These are things that I want to study more about. What do I know about this? What do I not know about this? And then if I'm being real candid, the other part of that paper is because it seems like whenever I study my scriptures, I think of all the things that I should be doing that aren't studying my scriptures. There's a small column on that paper that is a checklist of things that I go, oh yeah, I do need to renew my prescription. And so I'll write that down. And then once I write it down, it can be out of my mind and I can go back to focusing on the scriptures. Whereas if I don't have that, I'm like, I should. You know what? Why don't I just stop right now? I'll renew my prescription and then I'll come back to it. And then quickly I've found either no time or no focus in the scripture study that I've been doing.
Well, maybe those little hints of things you have to do is part of the inspiration from reading the scriptures.
Sure, sure. I don't discount that. I also know part of it is a symptom of ADD, which I have, and I am perfectly fine to own it and be able to treat it by writing it out and going, now I don't have to worry about it anymore. And then I have a checklist of things to do when I get done with scripture study.
Very good. And what about the family? Do you have regular scripture reading with the family?
Yeah, good question. So my wife is not a member of the church, so no, we do not.
Oh, okay.
I can remember as a kid some of the most precious times that I have, from my younger youth is reading the Book of Mormon with my dad. My parents were divorced when I was sort of a young tween. But I can remember the occasions where we would take to read from the Book of Mormon. Certainly knew how significant it was. My wife has before studied the scriptures with me, and we study in the first part of our relationship, we would study sort of spiritual or scriptural texts or things that would kind of evoke higher thinking or meditative sort of things. But as far as a scripture study, as a husband and wife, we do not do that.
Oh, okay. Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense.
She would if I asked her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a thing that, you know, sometimes you just go, okay, well, maybe not this right now.
Right, yeah. Well, now I'm curious, does she attend church with you?
She has in the past, raised Catholic schools, all the things. When we were first dating and probably for about the first, year of our marriage, she did. She met with missionaries as well. And then at some point, and it was really kind of around COVID when we obviously weren't going to church, she made the decision that it would be something that she would do when I asked her to. So if I speak, she'll come. If there's a class that, if I'm teaching Sunday school, right now I'm an elders quorum instructor, but if I was teaching Sunday school, she would come. There was a particular lesson that I'm like, man, I'm going to knock this out of the park, come and you know, be here with this. And then she'll also attend on Christmas and Easter as a part of, you know, a worship service. But other than that, very supportive of what I do. the thing that I've mentioned multiple times, it's a curiosity, I think, for a lot of people to have sort of a mixed faith marriage. And what I always tell people is that in a couple ways, one that I'll tell you here, it's pretty fantastic because we are a church full of traditions, of things that we do because that's how we've done them, and why wouldn't you do them the way that you've done them because that's how we do the things that we've done. And to bring into a life like that someone who does not feel that way is really great when you're going to do something and they go, why are you doing that? And then you have to go, well, because we've always done it that way. And then they go, but what if you did something not that way? And allowing you the opportunity to go, yeah, why do I do this? Mm-hmm. Or why do I do this way? Or why is this significant to me? So there certainly are challenges with having a mixed faith marriage, but one of the great blessings is the integrity she brings to the worship that I have by having to evaluate and or reevaluate, why am I doing this? I'm exhausted. Why am I going to church? Why is this important to me? Or tithing or temple attendance or any of those things. I appreciate the why are you doing this sort of check myself, yeah, that she offers.
That's very interesting. I've never thought of it that way. It's an integrity checker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
That's what, you know, some people are like, oh, but you met with the missionaries. Wouldn't you like her to join the church? Sure. Of course I would. But the thing that I appreciate about who she is, and I genuinely think this, and she has said as much, if I went to her and I said, hey, it is really important to me that you join the church and that we get sealed in the temple together, if I went to her and asked her to do that, I think that she would do it. Mm. But I don't think that that's what, I don't think that's how God intended people to join the church.
No.
And so I really appreciate when there are steps made in spiritual directions or when there are connections on spiritual things, it is because she has made the choice and that means something to her,
yeah,
as opposed to, all right, I'm forcing you, or here's a moment of conflict, I hope you choose the peaceful, mm-hmm, route, or, you know, acquiesce to the things that I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I don't have any of, yeah, that. It's an amazing moment when there is that connection through that, because I know it is the thing that she has chosen because she chose it.
Yeah, absolutely. We can't borrow another person's testimony to join the church. It's just,
sure,
it's not the way it's meant to be. Yeah,
sure,
absolutely. Well, I'd like to end here with your testimony. Would you mind providing that?
Well, sure. I mean, where do you, I should ask you how long, when people typically bear their testimony, is it long? I read a thing online today where people are like, a testimony longer than 2 minutes is a talk. It's not called talk meeting. It's testimony meeting. Is there a,
well,
I just don't
answer your question. I've had people go on for 5 minutes and it was their testimony.
Sure.
I've had some people, I think probably less than a minute. So there's no time limit. It's whatever you want to relay to the listeners of your testimony.
Yeah. All right. So, I know without, any sort of question, that we have a God that loves us in a way that we can't, you know, you always hear in a way that you can't possibly understand. And I think even the way that we sort of dismiss the way we can't understand it is our not understanding of it. I think that he knows us. I think that he knows what we need and what we don't need. I think that he sees the end from the beginning. I think that he wants us, I know that he wants us to love each other better than we do. And I think that he shows the example of how to love. And part of that is, you know, the love that he shared by sending his son, who, being able to find a connection to Christ, not being a part of the church, and being able to find a connection to Christ in being part of the church, and then, you know, and then finding like a reconnection and a changing relationship with Christ and Christ's atonement and understanding what that means. It is a challenge for me. It is a it's an adventure. It is never the same. What I feel like it was last week is not what it is today, and I don't anticipate it is what it is next week. I love that God cares enough for us to have leaders that are inspired, that can be able to guide in a way for a 21st century group of people who just want to do the best that they can give that individual and individuals the guidance that we need to not only be able to return to live with him, but also to be able to lead happy or happy-ish lives. It's not always meant to be happy, but you know, joyful, I guess, is maybe the word that I'm looking for. We can have joy. It's not always happy, but that we can have joy in what we end up doing. And I'm thankful so very much for and a large part of my testimony is knowing how God knew the experiences that I needed to have on a mission that would allow me to experience everything that I had coming home from a mission, that allowed me to be able to come back to the church. I think that had I served anywhere else with anyone else, that I maybe wouldn't be in the situation that I'm in today, but that God knew what I needed, knows me well enough, and provided me the experiences that I needed so that I could not deny the truthfulness of the gospel and my part in it. And it's fun to see for me how that plays out, because just when I think I've got it figured out, like, oh, that's clearly what it is, it's not what it is, or it's just such a small glimpse of probably what God sees in its totality. I love, you know, we within testimonies, we always talk about that, you know, we should talk about that we love the gospel. We should talk about the testimony of Jesus Christ. But I also just love, like, Mormon people. There's so much about the people that I just love. I know I'm not supposed to say Mormon, but Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is so long sometimes. But I digress. Like, just people, we are unique and peculiar, and I just love them in a way that I'm not doing a very good job of describing, but they converts or lifetime members of the church. There's just something special, unique, and lovely about them that that helps me, for whatever reason, helps me just sort of know of an overall truthfulness. And